The impressive photos by Christine de Grancy, which have been spread out on my desk since days, represent a challenge. The request to interpret gods, goddesses, and all their court, eternalized in stone on the rooftops of Viennese palaces, as symbols of historical currents between power and powerlessness, which have propelled the complete annals of humanity, conjures memories and thoughts that cannot be photographed and can hardly be captured in words. But even more so, it's worth a try. In the year 1977, I experienced the strongest feeling of my own power. Along with the telephone connection, the CSSR regime also confiscated my identity papers, passport, driver's license, vehicle registration, health insurance, and pension entitlement, and last but not least, they evicted me from my apartment in Prague. To top it off, a bit later, I was violently expulsed from my homeland to Austria. The most dreadful feeling of sheer powerlessness came upon me in the 1980s. My theater plays and novels were being performed and published around the world. I was honored with art prizes, decorated with state medals, and moreover, I had been selected as a member of the German Academy for Language and Literature. This schizophrenic paradox deserves to be analyzed, for in it reside explanations for one or the other phenomenon of the recent past. Twice burned as a child, in Czechoslovakia, the Great Depression of the 1930s was seen as the total collapse of capitalism, and the Munich Agreement of 1938 as a similar disaster by Western democracies. I counted among the many who already in the days of war had hopes of living in a better system in a post-war era. And with this mindset, the majority of the population cast their vote to a coalition of the Communist and Social Democratic parties in the free elections of 1946. But the long-desired socialism and the high expectations for the Soviet Union, both unfortunately Stalinists in nature, soon proved to be a Fata Morgana, which obscured a completely different agenda, a totalitarian empire, another edition of the Hitlerian. Slowly but now surely in the know, those Czechoslovakian leftists, who in all good faith had helped to take the wrong track from one evil to another, assumed full responsibility for their error. The course correction which they felt obliged to and cultivated over many years was called the Prague Spring of 1968 and was enthusiastically supported by most Czechs and Slovaks. A socialism with a human face should heave the old dream of generations out of oblivion and finally bring it to life. The entire planet held their breath if it would succeed for the first time in history that a dictatorship peacefully stepped back and voluntarily put its absolute power up for redistribution. The true rulers in Moscow and their vicegerents in Eastern Europe understood the danger correctly and swiftly flattened the project under tank tracks. The nocturnal ambush of 600,000 soldiers from 5 countries was branded brotherly help by the aggressors. But it also had positive sides. On August 21st, 1968, the masks had fallen, revealing what the communists' idea had been abused for since decades. However, most of the protagonists of the Czechoslovakian reform movement had not fled into exile and soon began to proclaim the B to follow up the A. That this bogus socialism isn't socialism at all, and therefore can never be reformed, only replaced with the best of all the bad systems, democracy. The omnipotent state apparatus lacked the most important instrument to tame its citizens, the right to torture and kill. It was the result of the so-called Helsinki Accords, a negotiation without which the Soviet Union would never have received the economic advantages it all too urgently needed. resolute opponents who were willing to accept all forms of harassment, including prison time, made the regime break out in a cold sweat. Charter 77 marks the pinnacle to this day. A pathetic handful of just 242 men and women signed this document in the first wave, urging the CSSR government to mind their own laws and protect human and civil rights in the spirit of the Helsinki Accords. The brisance of Charter 77 was that, for the first time in history of the nation, it reflected the complete spectrum of society. The topic had unified representatives from all political, religious, and social dispositions, and thereby created a departure point into the future. I had the task, among others, to simultaneously publish the document around the world, which eventually succeeded on January 7, 1977, with the help of a German journalist colleague. Then the enraged empire struck back with all means at its disposal. We lost almost everything that makes a person a citizen, from the telephone connection to the apartment. In the end, we were defamed as traitors in front of the camera at the most spectacular gathering of famous artists who had been commandeered to the Czech National Theater. The concentrated vendetta, which aimed to make us cave in under enormous pressure, lasted for more than 6 weeks until the regime itself backed down. It was now under the growing scrutiny of the global community, which granted the Charterists moral support and threatened with diplomatic but also economic consequences. Reluctantly, the Secret Service was kept on a leash, and we, albeit still non-people, could catch our breath for the next round. Those of us who had withstood the storm till then, such as Václav Havel, Pavel Landowski, my wife Jelena, and I, agreed that we had never felt so powerful as in the time of absolute powerlessness. Like being in the fabled eye of the tornado, where, as the saying goes, an uncanny calm prevails, we had watched an armada of politicians, police, and propagandists try to force us to capitulate for weeks on end and with all kinds of different weapons, but couldn't. We all felt the same thing, and the future fully confirms it, namely, that Charter 77 was like a civil Stalingrad, where the apparently invincible opponent lost its aura, a premonition of a looming defeat. Unfortunately, it would take another 12 years until the fragile bastion, euphorically called the Camp of Peace and Socialism, collapsed like a house of cards. At that point, I was already living my 10th year of involuntary exile, where I was brought by force. The former hushed-up author had now gained access to the many stages and publishing houses of the free world. The fervent leftist, however, was barred here from the hearts of the most logical comrades. An unsettling development set into motion, similar to the one that already misled millions in the 1930s. Back then, the leading left intellectuals of the West chose to fight for the justification of the political trials in the Soviet Union, in which dozens of alt-communists were sentenced to death as arch-enemies in disguise. The critics of these tribunals were maligned as minions of imperialism who were tainting the most just of all revolutions and trying to defraud the trust of the world. It needed 20 years and countless more victims before Nikita Khrushchev, in his speech at the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in February 1956, publicly conceded to at least a fraction of the horrible crimes, proving the former advocates of the manipulated trials wrong. And another 20 years later, a new generation of Western left-wing activists once again decided to declare the critics of so-called real socialism as corruptible accomplices of capitalism. Better red than dead, was the blue-eyed slogan by which even the total lack of freedom for people in the Soviet bloc was tolerated as a necessary evil. fresh revolutions in faraway countries were celebrated and supported, while the betrayed in the immediate proximity were not even ignored. Approached for support in the most difficult situations, many left-wing intellectuals found a range of excuses when they didn't outright refuse to campaign for counter-revolutionaries. When one of the younger Czech playwrights fell seriously ill in the mid-80s after 3 years of detainment in prison and I reached out to Western colleagues, the chairman at the time of the Association of German Writers replied in dead earnest that if one were to support the Soviet peace efforts first, then all the human rights problems would eventually solve themselves. This was the time when I experienced the deepest feeling of powerlessness. When I, in a part of the world where every person could obtain solid information and practice solidarity without a risk, ran into another wall. One built out of stupidity, cowardice, and egoism. A variety of limousine liberals once again took our testimonies and warnings as insidious treason against the holy work of socialism, shut their eyes in the face of the truth, and sided with the perpetrators instead of the victims. And in my great distress, I decided to turn to politicians. And it was the trio of Bruno Kreisky, Willy Brandt, and Olaf Palme whose bold intervention led to the release of a prisoner to a civil hospital and thereby secured him for the future. His name was Václav Havel. Fairly soon thereafter fell the Berlin Wall and the complete Iron Curtain vanished without a trace like a ghost. The fate of the playwright had bestowed me a catharsis beyond compare. When I returned to Prague for the first time in December 1989, where I still did not have a home, yesterday's criminal, now the freshly elected head of state, offered me the residence of his now out of office predecessor Gustav Husak for my stay. The rise from oblivion was all the more striking when, on the night to January 1st, 1990, the old president's villa was still under guard by the same state security which had banished me from my homeland just 10 years ago and now greeted me with almost a spark of fear in the eyes. So ready for the stage began the fourth act of my earthly existence. After the early years, which I spent as a communist on the side of the victors, after the middle years, which I experienced as a dissident with the defeated, after the mature years, which I passed through quite forlorn as an expatriate discredited by one-time comrades, I now understood that my life path had followed a course from power to powerlessness and then back to the realm of power. In the concrete matter at hand, my long-standing companion offered me the choice between the office of the Minister of Culture or that of the ambassador in Vienna. No play, no novel, no biography has taught me so much about the undulations of history as that night in the same bed where just a few days ago slept the man who had controlled the fates of 15 million Czechoslovakians for two whole decades and threw my life off track too. Stop. Wait a moment. An elementary question thrusts to the surface. Did he really throw it off track? Or perhaps the opposite, on the right track? Wasn't it precisely the failure of the Prague Spring and the brutal vengeance of the victors that unveiled the depths of human existence and united me right there with all those who then joined forces in the successful resistance against the manifold supremacy? The night in Husak's bed, a bizarre variant of the battlefield that the defeated occupant crept away from in disgrace, imbued me with an unfamiliar feeling of power. As if viewed from a heavenly tribune, I traced my complete marathon on earth, its mountains and valleys, and all of its hurdles, those I surmounted and those which I fell over too. In the remaining stretch, I would only be threatened by those that I set up by myself. For example, the temptation to finally liaise with true world power, to enjoy it to the full. And there I ordered myself, no. I thanked my friend for his trust and declined the high positions. As a carefree commuter between the 100 towers of Prague and the countless gods and goddesses on the roofs of Vienna, now I swirl in the wash of the Grillparzerian waves of sea and love. For after all the peripeties caused by the mentioned currents of history, I had achieved consummate power in the end. Power over myself.